only about 30% of the world's population traditionally lives in nuclear families. While in the West, the nuclear family has become the predominant family form over time, that's not actually true in low-income countries. It's not clear in low-income countries. The nuclear family is becoming more predominant.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Many times on Vox Dev Talks, when we're talking about how preferences are formed, decisions are taken, or policies implemented, we're talking about the role of the family. But what is a family? A new paper shows that over time and around the world, there are many different types of family structure. And it also makes the argument that unless economists understand the interactions between family and culture, their research may reach misleading conclusions. Natalie Bao of UCLA and Raquel Fernandez of NYU wrote the paper, and they both join me now. Natalie, hello.
Hello.
And Raquel, welcome.
Hi, Tim.
Raquel, I'll start with you. What was the inspiration behind this paper?
Tim, let me start out by saying that we're both delighted to have the opportunity to discuss our paper with you. It is a chapter for the Handbook of Family Economics. I don't know how inspiring that is, but that was our inspiration. More seriously, what we wanted to bring to this chapter that would be different from other chapters was to really draw upon a wide literature from anthropology, sociology, and economics, and try to bring it together, but focusing mostly, I would say, on the economics literature in this field.
And many of us, I suppose, because of where we grew up, how we grew up as well, we instinctively think of a nuclear family as the default and anything else as some sort of change from that. But how diverse are family structures?
So that's a great question, Tim. Family structures are incredibly diverse. So if you look at the ancestral characteristics data set, which is this very nice data set that matches current population data with cultural traditions, data on the cultural traditions from the anthropological literature, only about 30% of the world's population traditionally lives in nuclear families. Now, there's some caveats about this data. It's important to remember that this reflects cultural traditions, according to anthropologists, not necessarily current practices. And it's important to remember that a lot of the data on anthropological practices doesn't have as good coverage of Europe. But nonetheless, in places like India, which has a population of 1.4 billion people, joint families where big extended families live together are very common. And it's very common in many places for couples to live with either the parents of the groom or the parents of the bride. While in the West, the nuclear family has become the predominant family form over time, that's not actually true in low-income countries. It's not clear in low-income countries. The nuclear family is becoming more predominant.
And I suppose the question I have to ask is, why are there so many different types of family? Do we know?
So that's a really difficult question. And I think if we knew the answer to that, Raquel and I wouldn't be able to just answer it in a handbook chapter. We'd have to write a book. So I think it's hard to give one simple answer, and it's hard to summarize all the research that's kind of gone into this question. But sort of as a broad framework, we can think about cultural traditions, including family structure, as evolving in response to the economic environment and changes in the environment. So you can think about different cultural traditions coming out of learning and evolution. There's now a series of papers that look at how different cultural traditions or family structures might be affected by different sort of economic environment. So I have some work looking at the effect of formal structures of old age support, like pension plans, on co-residence between parents and their children. And the idea is that children will co-reside with parents when parents need to rely on their children for old age support. And so when you get pensions coming in, you might see a reduction in this co-residence. And that's actually what I find in Indonesia and Ghana. There's also quite a bit of work trying to understand why polygamist families arise. And so there's a classic work by Esther Basalop from the 70s suggesting that polygamy might be more common in places where women play a larger role in agriculture, which tends to occur in places where you don't need as much strength in agriculture and you can use small tools. And so in these cultures, female labor is more productive, and so you might see more polygamy because people desire to have more wives who can work on the farm.
A lot of economists are wary of the term culture. In the context of the family, why is it important, this argument that you make, for them to understand what culture means in their research?
Let me take one step back from that question and say why it is that economists have difficulty with the idea of culture to begin with. And I think it's a lot because we like to take things in what we call primitives, that there are people with preferences, that there are institutions, and there's basically an environment that you can take as given. And then you can ask yourself why things are different. For example, if you were to look at the French and you say, look, the French take more vacations, say, than Americans that take notoriously short vacations. Why is that? And you might say it's because they like to take time off more. And that's not a very good answer for an economist, because you're just explaining differences by appealing to something that you can't really observe, which is that they have different preferences. So there was a lot of, I would say, resistance in economics to thinking about culture as an explanation. Something that I've called the epidemiological approach, I think, was a big step forward in terms of being able to rigorously talk about culture by separating culture, that is, differences maybe in values and beliefs, maybe even preferences, although I'm more agnostic as to what preferences might mean, from other things like institutions or policy differences or just economic variables like how much education people have. And the way we did that was to study second-generation immigrants. So, for example, if we looked at women in the United States who work different amounts of time, or some participate in the workplace, some don't, and we ask, taking into account their education, who they married, etc., does where their parents were born help to explain how much they do? By studying these women in New York, that allows us to have the same institutions. They're all living in New York City, the same policies. We've controlled for their education. We've controlled for their husband's income. And now how much they participate, or whether they participate at all in the workplace, we think we can explain with their parents' country of ancestry. That's what I mean by second-generation Americans. I mean women who were born in the United States, but their parents were born elsewhere. So in the family in particular, it's very important to think about culture, because a family is one of the main transmitters of beliefs and therefore of the actions that people take later on in lives, whether it be what career they get into, who they marry, where they want to live, what their aspirations are. The family is a main transmitter of this, and culture is going to matter tremendously.
Yet, as you point out, the family is the main transmitter of social beliefs. We've covered this very recently indeed on Vox Dev Talks, when we're discussing the impact of learned gender attitudes on school-age children. I guess this is probably the most obvious example of that. Are there others as well?
I think that gender attitudes, gender roles, expectations, aspirations, these are all colored by one's experience in the family, by what the family's value system, culture system is. In developing countries, for example, the beliefs about the values of girls versus boys affects basic outcomes, fundamental outcomes, I'd say, such as sex selection, infant mortality, stunting. In developed countries, richer economies, it's going to affect family size, human capital investments, career choices, etc. And though I've seen far less work in this area than in others, the family obviously transmits other beliefs, like religious beliefs, party identification. Are you, you know, in the British context, conservative, a Labour, a liberal? Social responsibility. How much do you think you are responsible for others? The degree to which honesty might matter. One important area, and I will go back to gender attitudes, because even if you cover it, it's 50% of the world. And so I tend to think that this is a fundamental area to think about. But one of the areas that has received attention, both in the press and now in academic work, is the gender gap in math. And so you have work by Nallenberg, Rodriguez Planas, and Sevilla that uses the PISA, which is the OECD's programs for international student assessment tests. And they show that girls whose parents come from countries where there was a worse score by the World Economic Forum on gender, well, those girls whose parents come from those countries, even though they're all living once again in the same host country, they perform differentially worse in math than boys from those countries. And furthermore, they actually report that they don't like math. So, you know, your attitudes of liking something and being good at something, that's very much transmitted by your family culture. And there's similar papers that use other data like Dossi, Figlio, Giuliano, Sapienza. They use Florida public school data, and they show that girls' performance in math is correlated with families having a greater preference for sons, where evidence of that preference for sons is shown by those families being larger when their firstborn child is a girl, so they want to go on because they want to have a boy, than if their firstborn kid is a boy, and then they're more willing to stop, say, at 2 or 3, rather than keep on trying to get a boy.
You've also looked at the research on who in a family unit has power and how that affects the choices that the members of the family have. Can you give examples of how that works?
So obviously that's one of the most important ways that we can think about culture in the family. Mm. Culture affects power. Take something like divorce. The legalese of divorce, the economic ease of divorce matters, but also the social ease of divorce matters. Think about a country such as India, which is a country that Balkan Rao look at. The dissolution of a marriage is asymmetrically bad for women. It's not necessarily good for men, but it's particularly bad for women. This may keep women in situations of domestic violence. Husbands can use domestic violence to show that they're not satisfied with a marriage.
Yeah.
And by doing that, actually obtain further transfers from the wife's parents who actually care about their daughter's welfare. More generally, I would say that differences in income brought about for many reasons, including culturally induced differences in human capital accumulation, job market participation, gender roles in the families, is a huge contributor to power inequalities in the household. And again, just to give you a few more examples here, Nancy Chan has a very nice paper where she looks at the effects of post-Mao reforms in China. And she compares the reforms that increased orchard production, which was particularly favored male labor, with tea production, which favored female labor in different parts of the country. Basically, what she finds is that when you have increased tea production, what that did was to reduce the male to female sex ratio. That is, it led to, this was an era where there wasn't much sex selective abortion, that technology didn't exist, but you could effectively not take care of your girl child so well, either in illness or in terms of nutrition. Well, that made people take care of their girls more. In places that increased orchard production, on the other hand, that male to female sex ratio went up, so there were more boys than girls after a certain age. Furthermore, in terms of thinking about bargaining, what she found is that increased tea production was also associated with more education for both girls and for boys, whereas increased orchard production, the thing that favored boys, decreased education for girls. It left sons' education unchanged. One way to think about why you're getting these results is also because maybe the wife's bargaining power within the household is enhanced when tea production goes up because that favors her. She's going to get increased income. And this is really reminiscent of findings by others. For example, in the context of Mexico and Progresa, which is a conditional cash transfer program, what they found when they allocated income to either the wife or the husband instead, they showed it mattered who got that extra money. The wife got the extra money. She tended to spend this money more on purchases on kids' clothes, kids' schooling supplies, etc. Where I hate to sound, you know, rather conventional on this, but men tend to spend it more on tobacco and alcohol. So who has that extra money matters. Culture plays a role in determining who has that extra money because it determines also what activities you think you can go into. And it matters for a whole host of things. I could go on, and I think I'll just let the interested reader go further into our paper.
Or they could listen to a Vox talk that we did with Santiago Levy about Progresa and how...
Oh, wonderful.
Yes, and the decisions that they made around who was going to get the money and how that worked out. It was fascinating to talk about. Now, policymakers, they don't recognize these interactions between family and culture. You know, they experienced families themselves, so they'll know about them. But often they tend to focus on things like influencing individual preferences or changes in technology, not necessarily the culture of families. How important is this constraint for what economic policy can achieve?
I'm not sure that constraint is exactly the right word. Okay. I think that instead we want to think about how to make policy that understands that culture is important. Mm-hmm. And so I would not take that constraint as given. I would say we have to do better at making policies that are not just one size fits all. So actually, there was a very nice World Bank development report in 2015 that exactly made this point. And so while I think it's still the case that much of policymaking is not culturally relevant or sort of responsive to cultural details, I think it's increasingly being recognized by policymakers. And so those are actually two nice examples from my own work about how if you don't take culture into account, you're not going to potentially get the effects of policies that you want, and you're also going to mess up when you try and evaluate the effects of policies. And so one paper is a paper of Nava Ashraf, Nathan Nunn, and Alessandro Verina, which studies a tradition called bride price. With this tradition, the groom makes a payment to the parents of the bride at the time of marriage, and we realize that in these contexts, bride price is increasing in female education. And so this tradition essentially gives parents an extra incentive to invest in their daughter's education. And so we were interested at how this tradition interacted with large-scale school construction policies. And so we look at two natural experiments in two different countries, Indonesia and Zambia. These are two very different contexts. Indonesia is a mostly Muslim country. Zambia is a mostly Christian country. But both of these countries have variation across ethnic groups in whether you have a tradition of having a large bride price payment. And we find that when each of these countries did large-scale school construction programs, there was a positive effect on female education for daughters from the bride price ethnic groups, but there wasn't really any effect on daughters from the non-bride price ethnic groups. And so it turns out that this extra incentive to invest in daughters' education due to the bride price actually led the daughters in these ethnic groups to get more education relative to other ethnic groups. And so this shows that if you don't take culture into account, you're going to get things wrong. In fact, if we didn't separate things out by culture and we just estimated the average effects of the school construction program separately in Indonesia and Zambia, we would see basically a zero effect. And so we would just have concluded that school construction didn't do anything for female education, masking this really important heterogeneous effect. This also potentially has implications for policy targeting, because often we want to target policies towards the places that are going to benefit the most. And so it suggests that we don't just want to take into account sort of the economic features of an area, but also the cultural features of an area. I'll also briefly talk about one other paper that I mentioned before, which is my own work on pension plans in Indonesia and Ghana. And so in that paper, as I mentioned, I look at the effect of pension plans on traditions of co-residence between parents and their children. But that paper also has an extra twist. So the idea, similar to the bride price paper, is that when children are going to live with their parents and take care of them in their old age, parents have an extra incentive to invest in their children's education. And so if you have a pension program come in and children are no longer going to be the ones living with their parents and caring for them, you actually have this incentive disappear, and parents might actually end up reducing their investment in their children's education. And so to look at this, I study what within Indonesia, I look at the effects of a pension plan that came in the 1970s, and I basically exploit the fact that in some ethnic groups, daughters stay with their parents and care for them in their old age. And in other ethnic groups, it's evil sons or there's no real tradition. And I look at what happens to female education in response to the pension plan to daughters in those ethnic groups where daughters care for parents, versus daughters in the other ethnic groups. And I actually see that here, when the pension plan comes in, it clouds out female education among these girls who would have cared for parents. And in Ghana, I'm able to look at the flip side. I'm able to look at sons who would have cared for their parents in their old age. And I see there it clouds out education for the sons who would have cared for parents. And so here, not only is this saying we need to take culture into account when we do evaluation or when we do targeting, it's also showing that if we don't take culture into account, there can be big unintended consequences. And so, for example, if we had realized, or if policymakers had realized that the pension plan could cloud out education, they might have wanted to do other things along with the pension plan, like conditional cash transfers.
And finally, I've been talking to you as if the family as an institution is kind of some sort of fixed point, some immovable thing. And you do make the point in the paper, don't you, that sometimes the culture of a family can change very rapidly, can't it? Where are we seeing these changes at the moment?
Let me take that, Tim, as kind of almost two different questions, one which I'll find easier to answer, at least in light of my own work, than the other. Obviously, there's large changes in family structure. I mean, divorce used to be a rare phenomena. And then in the U.S. context, when laws changed in the early 70s, such that you were able to, according to which state you lived in, get divorced more easily than before, you saw a rapid increase in divorce. Before, it was legally difficult and also socially very difficult. So in the U.S., for example, now, I think at this moment, 25% of children grow up in single-parent households. Now, the U.S. is an outlier. It's very high. But in many countries all over the world, one of the things that we show in the paper is how much divorce has increased and also how large is the fraction of individuals who have never married in their lifetimes. Mm. Why has this happened? I think that is a literature that is far too small. And that is something that we'd like to understand much more. I think it's associated with a whole bunch of changes that have to do also in part with cultural change. For example, women entering the labor force and therefore being able to support themselves economically, independently of the husband, although not always very well, depends who the children stay with. Who the children stay with is itself a very interesting cultural question. It used to be assumed that children, I'm talking about 1800s, should be with the father. Then the presumption turned to, of course, children should be with their mother. Today, of course, this is a subject of intense legal contestation, as there is no presumption necessarily that the female is a superior parent. Now, there's not that much work done there. What's very interesting to me is that there is finally work being done that's showing that culture itself can change, often very rapidly. We've seen this in one area in the family, which is the prevalence of same-sex couples, which was something that, you know, really wasn't out there very much, say, 40 years ago, and now is. But I wanted to just touch upon work that's been done showing that culture changes and showing what gets it to change. Because I think there's important policy lessons furthermore that can be drawn from this. Even though Natalie and I are professors, we tend not to think very much of teaching or information or knowledge as a way that you change things. But actually, there's a few papers that show that indirectly this happens. There's a couple of papers, one of them by LaFerrara Chung Durea, and another paper by Jensen and Oster. The first one is in Brazilian context. The second one is in the Indian context. They show that soap operas that were introduced into these different countries at different rates in different geographic areas had real effects on outcomes that we as economists care about. So in Brazil, soap operas portrayed female characters often as having no kids or having few kids, which is very far from the reality that these women in these rural areas were living then. And then what the authors do is that they show that the access to getting the signal of the channel with the soap opera, which is watched by 80% of Brazil in its heyday, they show that it's associated with a decrease in fertility, especially for households with lower education. Presumably why is because these were being portrayed favorably. Jensen and Oster look at the effect of the introduction of cable TV on women's status in rural India. Again, taking into account when this arrives in different geographic area, they saw that in the 3-year period after the introduction of these cable TV programs, there was decrease in the reported acceptability of domestic violence towards women, decrease in some preference, and increases in women's autonomy and decreases in fertility. Just seeing something that portrays reality in a different way than what you're accustomed to can have profound changes on people's behavior. When it comes to politics, there is a very nice paper by Laurie Beeman and several co-authors, so I won't name them all. And what they do is they look at gender quotas for women in leadership positions in village councils in West Bengal. and these are randomly assigned gender quotas to these different villages. They show that after 10 years of having the quotas in place, once the quotas are removed, women are more likely to try to be elected and furthermore to actually win elections than in the prior two elections. Furthermore, they show that changed attitudes are a likely channel for this because they show via surveys that having had a woman counselor previously improves the perceptions of a woman's ability to be a leader and weakens gender stereotypes, both in the public and in domestic sphere. In my own work, going back to same-sex relationships, obviously attitudes towards this have undergone a sea change in all of our lifetimes. So in 1973, which is the earliest I have survey evidence for this, 80% of the U.S. population thought that same-sex relationships were either wrong, always, or almost always wrong. The proportion who think that went from 80% to 41% in 2016. In many countries, as you know, gay couples can now legally marry, they can have kids, they can enjoy all the rights previously restricted to opposite sex couples. So the question that we ask in my paper with Sahar Parsa is, in the context, at least in the United States, why did this change? And we show that for 20 years, starting in the 1970s, there's basically no opinion change. What we argue is, again, the importance of attention and information. We show there was a very large change in attitudes in 1992-93, and that coincided with the U.S. presidential election, in which Bill Clinton campaigned very much in favor of allowing gay people to serve openly in the military. The Republican Party assumed the opposite position. And this is the first time that you see the two main parties in the United States visibly take on opposite positions in their campaign platforms. This was followed by an unprecedented level of media attention on gay-related concerns over that period. And what we hypothesize is that it was the salience of these concerns that got a lot of people to rethink their positions instead of having an automatic knee-jerk position on this and to change their mind. What we show is that in those states, or in those counties, in fact, smaller than states, where there was a larger gay population, as we measure in a variety of ways, those are the places where everything else equal, people most change their mind. We sometimes talk about culture as though it's some individual belief held by the family. Of course, culture really is a social phenomenon. I mean, that doesn't mean there's not heterogeneity, but it is a social phenomenon. And it's maintained not only via individually held beliefs, but also by social carrots and social sticks. There's a really nice paper that makes a point both, again, of learning and how much what other people think may matter to what you yourself do. And that's in the context of contemporary Saudi Arabia. So Burstein, Gonzalez, and Yana Gizawa Drott have a paper where they brought people from the same neighborhood who may or may not know each other. These were all young married men. They were all college educated. And they said, what do you think the other people in this room who come from your neighborhood think about having your wife work? And these people, they thought very small proportion of their fellow neighborhood co-residents would be in favor of having their wives work. Once people had filled in those papers, it then revealed that information. And that information was much higher than what these people expected. And when they're told that information and they're given the option to either sign up for an Amazon gift card or a mobile phone job matching service, those groups of men to which the information had been revealed, whereas there's another parallel group of men to which the information hasn't been revealed, the group of men in which the information was revealed were much more likely to sign up for the job matching service than the group of men in which there was no information. So knowing what your peers think, knowing that cultural attitudes are actually different than what you thought, so this is a context of a country that's rapidly modernizing, that can affect how, not just your beliefs, but how you act towards your wife, the attitudes that you take at home.
We could talk about this all day. We can't talk about this all day, but we really could, couldn't we? So I think the best thing to do is to recommend that anyone listening to this takes Raquel's advice given earlier. Read the paper and then read the papers that are referenced in the paper. There are so many of them that are so interesting. I'm going to give you that reference for the paper in a second. But first of all, I have to say thanks to both of you for giving your time. Raquel, thank you very much.
Tim, thank you for having us. It was a pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. Natalie, thank you as well.
Thank you for having us.
I promised I would give you the reference for that paper. It is The Family as Social Institution. And the authors, you just heard from them, Natalie Bao and Raquel Fernandez. And it's a chapter in the Handbook of Family Economics, but first of all, you could get it as CEPR Discussion Paper 16213 if you want to look it up that way. Also, I would recommend that you listen to some of the VoxDev talks that cover papers that we've been talking about here. We've been talking recently about how children form their beliefs about gender attitudes, both in India and in Somalia, and how those can be influenced. Also, we mentioned Santiago Levy and his conversation with me about how he set up and ran Progress and some of the choices that were made. There are several others. How are you going to find them? Well, you're going to find them by subscribing. What do you mean? You haven't done that already, do it now on your podcast platform, and then you can look up all of these previous episodes that I've referred to. This has been a VoxDev Talk, and the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, as I say, is to subscribe on your podcast platform. If you want to look up our past episodes on the website, as ever, they are on voxdev.org.